Hello, this is Sophie, and you're listening to the Jew and the Gentile podcast.
I'm Charles Breton.
I'm Helena Epstein.
And I'm Chris Henson. Together we are
a Jew
and
a Gentile walking to
a bar
mitzvah.
Well, hello, Goose.
Is he recording?
Ooh, yes, we are recording.
Yep.
Yeah.
We just need Midge to be extra loud right now. Right. Make it sound Midge, like there's lots of people.
Yeah, for those of you who are expecting Midge Noble, we're sorry to disappoint you, but we're not. Midge. Oh.
It's my fault.
No, there's no fault.
Kind of is, though, but
just a little bit.
Just a little bit. So, for those of you who don't know who we are, I'm Charles Breton. I'm the Jew.
I'm Chris Henson. I'm the Gentile.
I'm Helena. I'm the ampersand of reason.
And we are a Jew.
And.
Let's try that again. A Jew.
And a
Gentile.
You know how many times it took us to get that in recording? Like
four.
Yeah.
Four. Yeah. Okay. Well, in my memory, it was 20.
Okay. We'll go. So we'll split the difference and we'll say 18.
Perfect.
Okay. So Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah, the podcast where you come for the theology, whiskey, cigars, and F-bombs.
We don't have any of those so far.
Oh, fucking
fuck
give us
that.
There you go.
There we go.
There's still no whiskey or cigars.
So the story behind that is
the whiskey. Well, the cigars are in my bag.
Okay.
And the whiskey's
and the whiskey's
the
at our camp.
Okay.
So
and
if you want, we can have Russ bring them over. We can light up. We'll certainly light up afterwards.
I'll probably skip the cigar, but I'll join you for the whiskey.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. We started out trying to be a Charles was said, like, we're just going to be an explicit podcast. I'm like, why will we need that? Not what, 2 minutes into the first episode? I figured out exactly why we needed the explicit rating.
Yeah. Our good minister here. So, and if you're hearing a fourth voice on our podcast, yes, you're not hearing things. We have a wonderful guest.
Things.
That's true. But I wanted to reassure them that there's actual a human being here.
And her second appearance.
Second appearance.
She's almost.
Yeah.
Well, she has a nickname, so we don't have to give her one.
True.
We nickname a lot of our repeat guests.
Okay.
So Alicia, a.k.a. the Transvangelical, is with us. She is a trans theologian, linguist, Bible translator, and sex worker. Much of her work touches on sexuality as an integral part of who we are. And she is currently writing her first book on connecting sex work and spirituality. And she is the creator of the Strip Theology Thursday series.
Yeah, you got which I've, oh, you which got
I've heard. I've heard the audio, so the theology is excellent. So I'll leave
thanks.
That, and you can and comment
actually,
on anything else.
Wait, where's that at?
It's so the video's on my OnlyFans. The audio's on my Patreon.
Okay.
So I have both set up. Those for who want the explicit and those who don't want the explicit, just
good.
Excellent.
But actually, my book is on a back burner right now because I'm working on. A book that I want to get out sooner, which is a 69-day daily devotional.
With absolutely
no
significance to that number.
No significance to that number. But bringing you things, bringing you little insights from Scripture, like the last thing, it's a normal daily devotional. We'll give you a Scripture and then a little thought, right? So, like, I think day one is the last thing said about Moses, which is his moisture never fled. And that's the verse I use. And then the little thought is, well, the last thing that was said about Moses was he was still able to ejaculate. So take encouragement today in your ability or someone else's ability to still ejaculate at an old age.
Yeah.
So this
is the day he died.
Up until the day he died. That's the type of devotional.
Be a raw man.
Well, now I certainly understand why Joshua was reluctant to take over leadership and follow Moshe. You know, I mean, that is
I feel there's a bumper sticker in this for us.
A hard act to follow.
You know, it's better when the pun is intended, Charles.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
Who knew?
Consensual puns.
Consensual puns.
Consensual punning.
It's important.
Yeah. Is it the hashtag?
Yeah, no context hashtag for you Twisted Sisters fans.
Consensual punning.
Yeah, non-context hashtag for you. So we also do want to mention that we are part of the GooseCast Network. The GooseCast Network is a network of faith-based podcasters who touch on such subjects as inclusion and social justice. To find out more about the Wild Goose Festival. So if you've never, who's here has heard of the Wild Goose Festival? Anybody? Okay.
Surprisingly, that wasn't everybody that's here.
Yeah. But if you're listening to us on our recording of this, because we are recording live at the Wild Goose Festival, you can find out more about the festival at wildgoosefestival.org. And just want to take a moment and recognize those institutions which keep us going, mainly Four Saints Brewery, great beer for great people, because their beer keeps us going. Top Leaf Cigar Lounge.
Makes our podcast sound better to those that drink it.
Yes. So if you drink it, we sound great.
Great.
Virgil Cane Rye Whiskey, the official whiskey of A Jew and a Gentile. Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, the premium lounge in the Triad. And a new shout-out I want to give to our good friend Pete Pike.
Pete Pike, make it.
Who
what?
Finally.
Deep cut, man.
Yeah.
That's going back to when we first started, kind of.
That's right. Our personal cigar concierge.
He was.
Has his own shop now. Greensboro Cigar Company. Great humidor he's putting together. And I've brought some goodies from Pete to share with us. So, Pete, congratulations on the new shop, and look forward to getting a lot of good.
You know what cigars he should carry?
What cigar should he carry?
I don't know. What would be your suggestion? Maybe the official cigar of the podcast?
Oh, the Felix Azzeline.
It's a good idea.
It's a good idea. Yes.
See, that wasn't scripted, but it sounded really damn
scripted.
But it
sounded really good.
All right.
And
prayers to continue for Felix's family.
Yes. But also, speaking of prayers, normally this is the place where we talk about the cigars we're smoking. We talk about what shows we're fangirling over. But we need to take a moment because a dear friend, OG Gooser, one of the kindest, most spiritual people we have ever met, a guide for us in our both in our spirituality and in our podcasting, is not here this year. And even though he hasn't been at the Goose for the last couple of years, what I mean he's not here, I mean he is not here physically on this earth anymore. But he is here spiritually because we carry him wherever we go.
Here, here.
And here. That is Phil Wyman. If you've listened to our podcast, you've heard Phil speak, you know of his work, if you have been at the Goose during its beginning days, you probably know Phil. He's the one with the red clown nose. He's the one who brings the carnivalesque to everything he does and to every place he goes. He brought whiskey, cigars, and philosophy to the Goose and many other festivals.
Somebody He's a mensch.
Talk.
He was a mensch.
Yes. So, Phil, we love you, and you will always be part of us.
Hear, hear.
So with that segue.
Is that my signal to put in a commercial?
Yeah. So we're cutting in a commercial right here. So we're going to pause. Four Saints Brewing Company. Four Saints pays homage to the patron saints of beer, St. Wenceslas, St. Nicholas, St. Luke, and St. Augustine of Hippo. They've become the most recognized patron saints for brewing and beer because of their contributions to and associations with the world's favorite sudsy beverage. Four Saints founders Joel McCloskey and Andrew Deming are carrying on the brewing tradition in hopes of future sainthood, or at least to make some really good beer. Four Saints Brewing Company, Asheboro, North Carolina. And we're back. And we're back here at the Goose.
See, y'all are the Patreon fans where you can skip all that stuff. I mean, we got to start a Patreon thing.
Put it
That's
on the
to-do list.
Damn
good idea.
Yeah, put it on the to-do list. So our topic today, which was suggested by Alicia, our guest, and I thought is a great topic to discuss and fantastic for the Goose. Reframing body and sexuality to subvert white supremacy. So first I'm going to turn it over to you to, I mean, that there's a whole lot there. So just
there's
that title, let's unpack that.
I had to ask him to break it down for me, just honestly.
Yeah, our Duke Div graduate's like, can you put that in real talk and not smart talk?
I think you used the term layperson.
No, yeah. You said real person speak.
I got the text. I said layperson. Well, lay people are still real people, Charles.
We have a guest. Let her speak.
The way I break it down is love boobs, subvert colonialism.
Okay.
That's the basics of it. There's a lot there that goes into how modesty and sexuality really has played a role in white supremacy, within colonialism, in creating a narrative of essentially those who should be respected, those who should see their humanity, and those who shouldn't because of different sexual expectations. And because of the way that a Eurocentric understanding of modesty has developed, it has been used in other cultures that don't see modesty, don't see sexuality in the same framework, to marginalize them and view them as sexually deviant. Mm-hmm. So essentially, in reframing the way that we understand sexuality, reframing the way that we view other people and being able to integrate their own bodily autonomy with their sexuality, with their personality, like, you know, understanding a person as a whole person and not just a sex object, like, actually does subvert a colonialistic understanding of the world, and it really subverts white supremacy. So that's the thesis statement there.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so whenever we look at the history of colonialism, like, without going too far back into history, because there's a lot, right?
Yeah.
So colonialism honestly started really with the Roman Empire. Other empires kind of did a similar thing, but colonialism really like took root in Rome. And then Christianity through Roman Empire, through European empires, like, became the imperial religion, right? And so Christianity became basically the foundation and justification for anything that was a cultural normative. So we get to the Victorian period, wherever there is this understanding of female modesty, that it's a little bit newer without going into like how that developed, because that's still like marginalization of women, but we're going to start there. But really, modesty within the Victorian period became not just a signifier of somebody like being holy, being pure, but it was also created a hierarchy of wealth and power, because you had to have money to afford the giant gowns that women would wear to cover up, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're a poor woman that had to help and work to make sure your family survives, you're not wearing as much clothes. So really, modesty in the Victorian period became a form of hierarchy to separate the wealthy from the poor. Mm-hmm. And with that came this understanding that modesty, covering up, really women's bodies, are this thing to be viewed as a determination of a woman's value. Now, like, we see that in purity culture today, like, we know that that still exists. But now, like, you take colonialism, especially as it branches off from the Victorian period, and these these people from Europe go into places like Africa, they go into the Americas, and they encounter these cultures that don't have the same background and don't have the same understanding of modesty. And instead of like looking up to them and going, oh, hey, this is really interesting, maybe we can learn something from them, Europeans are like, hey, these people are deviant and we have to subdue them and force them into a European understanding, because Europeans had decided that they had reached the peak of civilization, that God had blessed them. It was tied into Christianity, to the point where like you can't really separate them. We really can't separate religion from colonialism within a European context. Like, you just can't. And so these people decided that they needed to enforce their ideologies on other cultures. And because of that, things like modesty or the lack of modesty in other cultures became this narrative of sexual deviance that needed to be overcome. And it became a justification for things like slavery. It became a justification for indigenous schools, things that would erase cultures because they didn't align with a European understanding of modesty. They didn't align with a European understanding of gender and sexual orientation. And these narratives of sexual deviance became the justification for essentially genocide and cultural genocide, both physical and cultural genocide. And then we take that into America and we enter the time of slavery, where already there's that narrative of sexual deviance among people from Africa because, white people bring black slaves and have them on their plantations, right? Well, they, like, women would work and they couldn't dress in a white, rich woman modest way. And the men were not able to adhere to a masculine version of monogamy, because guess what? Your spouse can be sold at any time. And that played into that narrative of sexual deviance. Once slavery had ended, that narrative of sexual deviance became the justification of lynching. It became the justification for raping of black women, because there was this view that that black women, because they didn't follow these necessarily European developed modesty standards, that they were they would seduce men, right? And so that became a way to get a cop out of raping black women, was because they would say that black women were these seductive individuals. It's an incredibly messed up story, right? During the same time, we continued to marginalize indigenous people who had different understandings of gender and sexuality. And by the way, we had already erased the plethora of gender and sexual orientation from African slaves that we brought in, because we forced European understandings of sexuality and gender on people. But Africa has a rich history, different cultures in Africa have rich histories of gender diverse and orientation diverse people within their cultures. And Europeans, because it was considered sexually deviant, really tried to erase that. So this is the narrative of what we have coming into coming into America at the end of slavery, and then moving into like the civil rights movement. And we've really not addressed the fact that modesty in how it exists today is a way to reinforce white standards. And if we look at things like the dog whistles that the Reagan administration used, those actually came up as the things that purity culture in the 90s fought against, because there were always dog whistles of like the welfare mom, right? Which wasn't actually a thing, but people believed it. And so you have in the 90s people like trying to teach a sexual ethic that would essentially make sure that people didn't end up like that. And purity culture of the 90s is actually a very, it's very connected to the racism of like the Reagan administration that really came out. So the fact is, like, the way that we view sexuality, the way that we view modesty, the way that we view other people's bodies and feel we have an ability to determine their worth, their value based off of how they present themselves is a white tactic to oppress other people. So really what we, like, one of the most subversive things that we can do is actually have a healthy respect for boobs. And that's really what, because there is nothing inherently sexual about boobs. We have made it a sexual thing because of culture. We teach that to our children. We teach our daughters to cover up and not go topless like their brothers, right? We have created the sexualization. It's not an inherent human thing to find boobs sexual. There are plenty of cultures out there that don't, right? So the fact is we as a culture are sexualizing children, and we are teaching children that girls who are immodest because they have breasts or show their breasts are somehow going to be determined, like their character, their worth is going to be determined based off that. And that's completely messed up because it is cultural way of marginalizing people and oppressing people. And it has a history of being used for white supremacy. So my thesis is, if we actually change the way that we see human sexuality, see attraction, recognize, like, people that are married, you should have a healthy sexual attraction to your partner. If you're ace, then maybe not. And it works for you, because we're not going to be ace phobic here. It is okay to have a sexual attraction to your partner if that is the way that you're inclined, right? But you still see let's be honest, the evangelical way of talking about marriage doesn't do this, but you should see your partner as a full person that includes their sexuality. And the fact is, we have to extend that to understanding that sexuality is a part of every single person, regardless of your relationship to them. Like, every person here has sexuality as part of who they are in some way. It is ingrained in who they are. And the fact is, our culture has tried to separate it in order to have a narrative to oppress. And that is the thing that we are trying to subvert by changing the way that we view other people's bodies as sexual. So there it goes.
So again, a lot to unpack. Some of the thoughts that, you know, I had, one of my soapboxes is, people tend to blame Constantine for weaponizing Christianity. Okay, he did for a while, but the real villain was Charlemagne, because he did it on the industrial scale. And did it to colonize all of Europe. So I just throw that out there. You know,
Charlemagne definitely did brought in the colonialism. But at the same time, I think blaming Constantine is like a cop out, because why are we blaming Constantine for being the person that just accepted what other people had already developed? Like, Christianity doesn't become an imperial religion without it turning into something that is enticing to the empire.
It doesn't
just happen overnight where emperor is like, oh, I'm gonna take this religion and change it. It already gotten there. Constantine just like, oh, hey, this will work for me,
right? And Charlemagne was the one here you're talking about saying, oh, this is what you're doing, because, you know, he would go in, and first the priests went in, and then the army followed them, and then the priests would stay, and it was, oh, so you guys are worshiping this cup. Okay, you can keep doing that, but this cup now represents Christ.
Yeah.
And would just totally change and just imprint the white Christian European notions onto whatever anybody else was already doing, because they found that was easier than making you change your behaviors. They changed what you associated and put those values. So you're talking about, oh, yeah, so your body, well, you know, yeah, that's nice, you celebrate body. You can still do that. But understand that now we're talking about the body of Christ, which you're a part of, and, you know, and they changed all the value judgments to match theirs.
Which actually makes it like really history to understand the history of other cultures, mm-hmm. because we generally speaking, we don't have history from the people that were colonized. We have we have the history of the people by the colonizer, which mm-hmm. I had to break it to you. It's not going to be as accurate as we might think it is.
Yeah.
Gasp.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I thought it was interesting because my job in this triumvirate is to bring the Jewish perspective. Mm-hmm. So the rabbis of the Talmud not only recognize that the sexuality and sexual relationship in a marriage exists, they're like, yeah, it's really important. Mm-hmm. And first of all, modesty in Judaism has nothing to do with your body. When there's all these things about dress modestly. Mm-hmm. In Judaism, that means don't flaunt your wealth.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to get the biggest, you know, best thing. Just, you know, dress nice and, you know.
Which is interesting because that's like the opposite of what we're taught in purity culture, right?
Right.
Because it might not be wealth, but it's flaunting your holiness, essentially. Yeah. So the way that we talk about modesty within purity culture is actually breaking what the scriptures say about modesty.
Right. And in the Talmudic tradition with the rabbis, like, there's actually, I forget which rabbi who said that, because you're talking about boobs, he said the tip of her little finger is enough to excite her husband. That the focus is the person, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't matter what, don't fixate on her body, but, you know, that's, and so when they do things, like, there are some things in the more Orthodox traditions, one of the things is married women cover their head. And the reason they do that in Judaism is, now, this was written at a time when everyone was living in the Levant. So if you know anybody from that region, I think you'll agree with me that this is absolutely true. For the rabbis of the Talmud, hair was one of the most sexually attractive characteristics of a woman. Yeah. And so if you've seen any Semitic women, I think you would agree, yes. Hair is a real turn on. And the reason that they ask married women to cover their hair isn't, oh, you're now tempting men. Oh, don't, you know, it's not the modesty, purity culture thing. It's sexuality is great. It's important in your relationship, but that's between you and your partner. So save it for them.
The Talmud hadn't gotten to polyamory yet.
Well, actually, they had left that, and now they haven't come back.
But
to it yet.
But it was polygamy, which was
male focused. Thing. Yes, exactly. But just this idea that, you know, in any relationship,
yeah,
what turns you guys on? That's great. You know, and the more that you keep it just for who's in your relationship, makes it that much special for your relationship. So it's not a shaming, oh, you slut, I can see your hair. It's, no, that's between you and your partner. So
yeah. And I think, well, I mean, from a more, so this is going outside of the Talmud, I'm sure, which I think
we do that
fine.
All the time.
We do that all the time, right? But that actually has a lot to do with, has a lot to do with consent in mm-hmm. the way that we understand it, and not necessarily this purity understanding. So like, there should be consent between you and your partner with how you deal with your sexuality going out to other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't leave your partner behind if you are like, if you're gonna be polyamorous, like, make sure your partner knows, right? Like, consent is super important, like. And I think that, to me, those types of teaching, like, I find them to be, within their time and place, obviously, but it does encourage a little bit more of that understanding of the fact that relationships are meant to have a back and forth and a communication. Whereas mm-hmm. within Christianity, we are like, no, this is how you do it. This is the biblical marriage. And mm-hmm. it's like, the biblical marriage from what, Jesus, Paul, neither of them were married.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to go by a biblical marriage, like, there's more in the New Testament about refraining from marriage than there is mm-hmm. getting married. So the idea that there isn't like a standard biblical marriage, and if husbands follow it like this and wives follow it like this, it's going to be happy. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's actually not going to work out. There's a lot of studies showing that it is in fact terrible.
Yeah.
And people will stay together because they don't want to go outside the biblical marriage.
Right.
But
well, unless it's the biblical marriage of Isaac. Right, let's
fair.
One. Oh yeah, that's right. Two wives. Okay.
Yeah. but yeah, there's just so much more healthy ways to understand sexuality and relationships mm-hmm. outside of what Europeans conceived of within their Christian framework.
Oh yeah. Well, more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, that can be conceived by your poor philosophy. I know it's not Rambam, but a Shakespeare reference is pretty good. So.
I do
want to take a moment, though, because we've got a bigger crowd. So, again, those of you who are expecting Midge Noble, we're sorry we're not her. But she will be podcasting Saturday at 1. So come back Saturday at 1 to hear Midge's Gay with God podcast. So with that said, when you first presented this, I went to my happy place, which is the total destruction of Western philosophy.
I mean, I'm all for that.
Yeah. Because
Lord.
Because this is my mantra.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay. So Neoplatonic thought is all based on all binaries are oppositional. Mm-hmm. Right? That is the basic tenet of all Neoplatonic Western thought. Yeah. In Eastern religions, yes, there are binaries, but they tend to be complementary, or they are on some sort of spectrum. In Western Neoplatonic thought, there's binaries and they're oppositional.
Okay.
Well, binary oppositions beget choice. Choice begets privilege. Privilege begets all the fucked up things we have.
Can you say that again, but in the voice of Yoda?
No, because then I'd have to reverse it, and I don't know. And choice begetting that does.
You speak sound Irish there.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
Hey, maybe it was. I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead. Go ahead. You're doing good.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. 154 episodes, and I finally got a compliment.
One compliment.
Wow.
Wow. I'll just edit it
okay,
out.
Okay, we're done. Thanks for coming. No, and I because when you're talking about body, when you're talking about sexuality, and you're talking about the Western tradition of it, mm-hmm. it's one or the other, right? Good or bad. You know, the whole Madonna or whore.
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of things, you know, body image. I was recalling when you were talking about the dress, a comment that my comparative lit teacher was talking about. Okay, medieval and Renaissance, the ideal European woman's body was plump and pale. Because mm-hmm. if you were plump and pale, that meant that you were wealthy enough to not have to work outside
mm-hmm.
and that you could eat. And then we fast forward into the 20th century, and the ideal body image is thin and tan, which means you were wealthy enough to exercise and have the time to exercise and go to dietitians and hang out at the beach, and you didn't have to labor all day long in a factory. So when we talk about, the ideal body, when? So even yeah. within Western culture, it is evolved and changed. So to insist that there is this ideal, which is my other rant against Plato, for God's sakes, people, there are no shackles. Walk out of the goddamn cave. Okay? We are what's keeping us in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And yes, it's not a. I'm going to mention Derrida because we're at the Goose. Derrida does a great job. If you haven't read Speech and Phenomenon, he does a great job of totally destroying Husserl and Plato in the realm of the ideal.
Sounds good.
Yeah. That there is no such thing as the realm of the ideal. So even just the phrase, the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, but in terms of this, the ideal body, either male or female body image, is a social construct, a cultural construct.
I think even taking it further, like, there's this new push within, like, conservative Christianity of calling things Gnostic. If you've seen that, it's completely ridiculous, because the idea of Gnosticism is that there's the spiritual and the physical is evil and the spiritual is good, and you have to rid yourself of the physical to get to the spiritual. And if you apply that to modesty within a Christian Western framework, you have Gnosticism, which is like basically what they see as the greatest heresy. So even within Christianity, this idea of like the ideal physical, well, lack of physical, because the point within Christian like modesty ethics is not to accept your physical body, your flesh. Actually, that's a terrible, because Paul's like binaries that he uses is not meant to be, like you said, it's not meant to be a opposing. It's supposed to be like complementary in a way. And yeah, it does change the text whenever we understand that Paul didn't have a Western thinking. He actually had an Eastern thinking. Anyways, the very thing that like people call like the greatest heresy is actually what they rely on for things like modesty. And it's creating that duality that the church ruled as heresy, but they, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's so weird. It's like, it's kind of like Christianity upholds an ahistorical understanding of the world. Gasp. Like,
shocked. Yes. Shocked to discover gambling is going on here.
So I'm just listening.
You've been very quiet.
We saw.
And I'm just going to kind of free flow for a minute.
Go for it.
Something you said pushed a button for me when you were talking about the covering of hair, because hair in that culture was considered sexual and that should be saved for her husband. Wait a minute.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should be saved for her mutually consensual sexual relationship with her husband. I don't hear that differently than I hear cover your breasts.
Yeah.
And when you talk about sexuality, a human being's sexuality is not confined to themselves. It's generally confined to a relationship to another person or persons. And at what point is modesty not defined against what someone else thinks might be sexual for me?
I mean, I don't know.
Good point.
If you're going to argue from the Jewish tradition, I don't know what it is. For me, like, your sexuality is all within yourself. Like, if you have a relationship with somebody, you should have communication, but that communication is centered not in that relationship, that's centered in yourself.
Right.
Mm.
And two people who have full bodily autonomy, deciding how they're going to interact. And if that relationship includes other people, then it's a bigger conversation. But at no point does anybody have, like, nobody should have rights to another person's body, because it should be all about consent. And so, like, I only have one partner right now, and like, we both agree that we both have bodily autonomy. We have our own like boundaries within our relationship, not necessarily with like modesty, because like we don't care, but like we have boundaries of I don't use her story in my space, because those are her stories. I'm not using her story to build myself up, right. That's a boundary that is built within the autonomy of myself and within her.
Well, that's what I mean. I feel like, even though like I have my own internal sexuality, when you start talking about modesty, you're talking about how that sexuality intersects with other people.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Like, at what point do you have ownership over your sexuality to the point where you can also have full ownership over your modesty?
Yeah.
Because when we're talking about modesty, frankly, like, I'm going to a place of safety.
Mm-hmm.
For me, being modest is being safe.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's something that I don't think like men deal with in the same way.
Oh, absolutely.
No, they
not.
Definitely don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely not.
Having
both,
existed,
but like, that's not a conversation that you can probably understand or appreciate in the same way. right? Like, oh, yeah. But I can existed like, as we're in talking both worlds. About, yeah.
It's, yeah. There yeah. is a very big difference.
So
yeah.
like when we're talking, like it's the history and the philosophy is awesome. And I love, mm-hmm. I love learning and I love hearing discourse, but also we've chose a topic that goes straight to like a core issue of yeah. safety, mm-hmm. which again is
yeah,
then
it's definitely something that is yeah. I didn't cover.
Yeah.
Because there is that.
Yeah, yeah. And that is, I think, magnified and extrapolated even further outside of my own like Eurocentric perspective.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so that safety issue is even higher that like when we're talking about white supremacy, we're also talking about safety.
Yes.
Right. Like, so what are the, I guess to me, like when we're having this conversation, I'm thinking about that. And then I'm also thinking about, you know, Charles earlier when we were pre-gaming a little bit was talking about the Shulamite woman. Right. And mm-hmm. her and mm-hmm. her place of reverence, right? Like she was in a safe space, but she also wasn't ish. Yeah. yeah. She was revered. She was held with care by her partner.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I would say, but the daughters of Jerusalem, not so much.
Right.
Which
not
is,
so much.
Yeah.
Right. But like.
And her overprotective brothers, who
not so
didn't
much.
Want. Yeah, yeah. Not so much.
Yeah, but just how theologically you support people that are in those positions, those more tenuous positions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm realizing that the way that I've talked about it so far might not have conveyed my understanding quite right.
Okay.
Because to me, modesty is a social construct.
Yeah, 100%.
And the fact is, even within a relationship, like, it's still a social construct. And I just think that there should be communication in a relationship, but if a mm-hmm. relationship like requires modesty, that's going to be unhealthy because modesty has been used as a form right. of oppression. Now the safety aspect, like that is what actually my partner and I talk about the most is, hey, if you wear this to this place, there might not be, because mm-hmm. I'm newer to the women's spaces, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, there is that conversation of, like, experience from her side where I'm learning about, I guess, modesty, but in more of that protection sense. And kind of the fact is, it's not just white supremacy. It is also male supremacy that uses modesty as a justification for harm against women. Right. And mm-hmm. like it's, yeah. it wasn't just with, like I said, that white men would accuse black women of being seductive. Like that, we're still seeing that today. And it does cross racial boundaries. If a woman gets raped, there's still that person asking, what did she wear?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So the fact is we have to subvert the concept of modesty altogether. Like it has to go. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it also the point of what you're talking about is that we can't start doing those things unless we recognize it.
Yeah.
And once we do that, then the point is not just to keep it as a theoretical, but okay, it's a social construct. So let's take it apart and put it back together in a way that
or don't
addresses
put it back together,
that doesn't
take it apart and
take
address
it apart.
It. Yeah,
but I mean the construct and build something that addresses those safety things so they're not there, you know. So,
I don't know where we're on time.
Well, we're getting close, but we're at the time where traditionally at the Goose we like to open up, since we actually have an audience and we're not just talking to ourselves. For questions or comments that you have, would you be willing to MC with your microphone there? And
do you want to come up?
You can come on up.
Jennifer's coming up.
I just had a comment on the modesty and safety issues. I know that women don't experience safety no matter what they're wearing. Mm-hmm. From the women in Arabic countries who are covered head to toe to women wearing the skimpiest bikinis on the beach, there's no guarantee of safety. I saw a project recently where, not to trigger anybody, sorry, but they like people, especially femme presenting people, posted the, what they were wearing when they were sexually assaulted, mm-hmm. and there was absolutely no consistency.
No.
And so this idea mm-hmm. that modesty can be safety, I think, is just something that's really, really something I think that it doesn't work. And even when the right tells you that it works, it doesn't.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, that's it's fair, but it canard. Is like a strong, it is the guttural reaction to the topic, whether it's right or wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely, it's a social canard. You know, because first of all, right, rape isn't about sex. It's about violence and control and power.
Yeah.
Right. So if someone is inclined that way, it doesn't matter what you're wearing, where you are, who you are. Right. That is. So they use it to, again, deflect from themselves. Oh, I was tempted. And, you know, yeah. So
well,
it's bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, it is bullshit. Jennifer, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but often, at least whenever I talk with my partner about it, it's not necessarily, it's not about modesty per se, it's about not standing out. And that's more what we talk about whenever we talk about what I'm wearing is,
yeah, you want to dress in relationship like, to your environment.
Yeah. And that is a form of safety, because if you don't stand out, then there's possibly a chance that you won't be singled in on. But again, that's not technically modesty, right? That is, it's more of a form of camouflage than modesty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was going to say that gets to your point
mm-hmm.
about then you, because the culture has ingrained in you or has set up this system where you do not feel safe, where you limit your own sexuality and how it's expressed. Right.
Yeah.
And so it does, these things culturally do not allow you to be fully who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And that's not good.
It is an extension of power and control mm-hmm. over other humans.
Exactly.
To say that to create an environment where somebody can't express themselves and who they are mm-hmm. is to exercise power over that person.
Yeah. And let's be clear, when we say people exercising power, we basically mean white men.
Basically, but it's not just white men. It is in fact the entire culture and system that has been developed primarily through giving white men power.
Yeah.
So it is inherently whiteness, it is inherently male. But whenever we talk and say that it is not individual white men.
Oh, no.
It is a culture. A systemic culture that has been developed that has put white men on a pedestal. Melissa
yes.
Wilcox will talk about the fact that white cishet men are the non-sexed.
Right.
And the further that you are from the white cishet man, the more sexual deviant you become.
Be mm-hmm.
And that's the culture that we live in. So like a non-binary femme black person will be seen culturally as more sexualized, more sexually deviant than an SBC pastor, right? and mm-hmm. even if we look at, because if we look at like history and facts and statistics about SBC pastors as opposed to non-binary femme black people, we're going to find out that one is in fact more dangerous than the other, but our culture will not see it that way.
No. Anybody else? Comments or questions? Well, then as we do with all our episodes, we're going to end with words of wisdom. And these are quotes that are just taken at random. There's no attempt at all to match any of the quotations that we choose
Absolutely.
To any of our topics or anything.
Drawn from a bucket.
Yes, totally at random. So we just randomly selected this quote from Martha Graham. The body is a sacred garment. It's your first and last garment. It's what you enter life in and what you depart life with. And it should be treated with honor.
I'm going to say that wasn't random.
totally, absolutely.
You just open Google just and open. Scroll.
Yep. Yes.
Boom. There it was.
Google quote. And yes.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
I'm Helena Epstein, and I'm still the Amber Sand of Reason.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah. Wishing I could change
the things that I... Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/EthanSapphire. Give back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you got